Well, we're here today with Dr. Jay Richards, and we're talking about socialism, distributism, and his book, The Hobbit Party, which he co-authored. Dr. Jay Richards is an assistant research professor at the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and the executive editor of The Stream. Richards is the author of numerous scholarly and popular articles, as well as four books, including The Untamed God and The Privileged Planet. In January 2008 at Stanford University, he debated the leading atheist, Christopher Hitchens, on the topic atheism versus theism and the scientific evidence of intelligent design. And it was moderated by Ben Stein. Eventually, that became the movie, I'm guessing, Expelled. No intelligence allowed. A lot of us have seen that. So, Dr. Jay Richards, welcome aboard today.
It's great to be with you.
Now, tell us about this book. You got it in your hands. Pull it up. We'll put a shot on the screen.
Here it is. It's called Hobbit Party. It came out actually in late 2014 with my longtime friend and conspirator Jonathan Witt. And we timed it actually to come out right before the release of the third installment of the Hobbit movie. And Witt and I had been longtime good friends since we were about 6 years old and big Tolkien fanatics as kids. And had honestly gotten frustrated because we felt like a lot of people sort of on the political and theological left had been trying to conscript Tolkien for a long time. This had been happening since the 60s and 70s when the psychedelic movement in the U.S. tried to appropriate him. And we just thought, this is completely unfair to Tolkien's thought. I mean, especially since we have published letters over a period of decades with him expressing his ideas. And so out of frustration more than anything else, we finally said, we really need to do a book talking about Tolkien's actual ideas on the family, on economics, trade, markets, and freedom in his letters and also his private views, because we really think it's much closer to a kind of traditional view on these things than a lot of the Tolkien secondary literature would lead you to believe.
Excellent. Great. Well, one of the things we wanted to talk about was distributism, because this has been a hot topic. Tim and I have taken some shots at it over the last several months, and people are like, you got to talk about this. We've also received some criticism, haven't we, Tim?
Yeah, live on the Twitter feed. Yeah.
Yes, and the comments. Yeah, and on the live chat. And I published a bunch of quotes from popes against socialism. And we've talked about capitalism some, and then people say, oh, well, both of those are really both evil. Let's just use this Shangri-La theory called distributism. That fixes everything. That's the real Catholic viewpoint. And Tim and I said, not so fast. And so we'd like to talk. We'll talk about a lot of things today. But Dr. Richards, what's your take right off the bat? Distributism.
My simple take is that you could at least say, okay, you could derive from a few encyclicals something vaguely like distributism. So I wouldn't want to say it's completely alien to Catholic thought or any encyclical by the Pope. On the other hand, I think it's completely implausible to claim that there is a Catholic sort of theory of economics. In fact, popes such as John Paul II explicitly denied that. They said, first of all, Catholic social teaching is not a third way between capitalism and socialism. You won't find the word distributism, as far as I know, in any encyclical. The term, was really popularized by two great thinkers and writers, G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, who I think on many things are obviously very acute observers. Neither of them studied economics. And if you read, for instance, Belloc's Servile State or his essay on the restoration of property, read it alongside the Communist Manifesto, and you'll discover that Belloc and Marx had actually the exact same view of wealth. See, now, of course, Belloc's not a Marxist, but there was this idea popular, especially in the 19th century, called the labor theory of value, which basically said something's only worth as much as it costs to produce it. If you think that's true, then if, say, a factory owner hires workers to make shirts, and then he goes out and sells those shirts for more than they cost to produce, then on this labor theory of value, he would have exploited the workers and the customer. Well, we know this labor theory of value is just not true. It just completely makes a mess of everything we know about economics. If the labor theory of value were true, then a guy digging a ditch in the desert would produce the same amount of wealth as the same guy digging a ditch in the back of a backyard in Santa Barbara working for a contractor to build a swimming pool. The labor isn't what makes the difference. It's the social context and need. And so the Number theory of value is just, you know, it was a kind of intuitive idea, but it was fundamentally flawed, and it's certainly obsolete. And so this is the problem with distributism. It is that it imports a very particular view of economic reality, of the nature of wealth, that's not in any way dependent upon Catholic theology or philosophy, into the discourse. And so then it claims to be this magical third way between capitalism and socialism. But if you actually look at, okay, what policies would you need to implement distributism, which claims, well, distributism is the idea that we want a widespread distribution of so-called productive property. That's Belloc's definition. Oh, so how does that work? Well, it turns out that it works by the government punishing any business as soon as it gets very popular and big, and cutting it down to size and redistributing the property, which it would effectively just destroy all domestic industry in short order, and essentially punish success. And so there's the irony, is that distributism claims to want decentralized power through property owners, but to be implemented, it would require absolute power over private property on the part of the government. And so it's, I think it's fundamentally just an incoherent view.
Yeah, distributists are always defining items, economic worldviews, in terms of their supposed effects, right? That's how they describe capitalism. Mm-hmm. Ask any distributist, and they'll define it roundly for you as dirty smokestacks, aggregated, consolidated wealth in the hands of some jerks somewhere. Right. And they'll say that distributism is, you know, you're all of a sudden your athletic shoes smell good. Everyone's got 3 acres and a mule, and they'll refuse to talk in terms of the two rights, property and contracts. Right. Mm-hmm. Now they'll tell you property is going to be well distributed, I guess, given the name. But what is their deal with the right of contract? Right. I mean, capitalism involves property and contracts.
Yeah.
And you never hear about contracts.
Well, you don't. It's sort of obvious why. I mean, I think that at least some of them, their distributists are diverse, of course. And so people, distributists try to resolve these kind of internal contradictions in different ways. But normally they'll just dismiss contract as if, well, a mere consent to an act is not enough to confer moral validity on it, which is, of course, true. You know, you can consent to something that's morally evil. Nevertheless, it's an important thing, and it's the essence of contract. And if you're going to, it's very difficult to have real rights to property unless you also have a right to contracts. I mean, what does it mean to have private property if you're not able to sell it, you're not able to lease it, you're not able to use it for various purposes? I mean, it's essentially meaningless. And I do think that, you know, the distributists I've met, I've debated some, like Joe Pierce, who's a great guy, and Dale Alquist and folks like this. Here's what I think the fundamental problem is. With distributism, and this is frankly very popular in Catholic and Protestant circles, is to treat economics as if it's merely an ideology. In other words, to treat economics as if, oh, it's all it is utilitarian philosophy or liberalism or individualism or something like that, which means that there's actually no economic knowledge. So supply and demand and comparative advantage and scarcity, those are all presumably just kind of theory-laden aspects of, you know, materialist philosophy. Something which is absurd. I mean, there's a lot of things that we simply know from economic science. It's not everything every economist says, but we understand what prices do in a market economy. We understand the effects of private property. We understand the relationship between supply and demand. Effectively, distributism just wants to say there aren't any actual economic truths. All there is ethics. And so we'll just take our particular kind of eccentric take on Catholic ethics and apply that. And then we can ignore actually having to know anything about economic reality.
Yeah.
Let me put up a question here, and y'all can either one of you or both of you can do it. And that is, how is it any different from socialism, distributism versus socialism?
Well, I think at first, it's obviously different rhetorically, because socialism, you know, at least in Webster's dictionary, is the collective or state ownership of the means of production. Distributists will say, oh, no, we don't want that at all. We want private ownership of the means of production. We just want the means of production, productive property, by which presumably they usually mean factories and farms and things like that. We want it to be widely distributed among private actors, families and individuals and things like that. So rhetorically, it's quite different. The problem is in order to get to this distributist Shangri-La, you need what is effectively a socialist stage. And that actually makes it very similar to Marxism. That's what Marxism said, is that you'll have this thing called capitalism, which was ill-defined, followed by socialism. In socialism, you'd have the state owning the means of production. And then after the new socialist man emerged, the state would win away and you'd get this stateless communist utopia. I think in some ways the distributists have the same sort of ideas, that you're going to have a kind of state in which you get this robust distribution from the government, and then the government's going to step back and just let all these private actors, I suppose control things. It's completely bizarre. It's completely unrealistic. It makes no sense of what we understand about incentives and human nature. And I think it's just, it's not Marxist, but it's utopian in the same sort of the same way that Marxism is.
I'll give that one a different, a robustly different answer.
Right.
I'll back up a second. First off, I should just say that I forgot my cornflower blue Russell Westbrook flowered shirt. So sorry, I violated code here today. I'm sorry. You guys both have it, and I'm out of uniform. Yep. I took contracts and property from a couple libertarians in law school. It's actually one of the reasons I went to USD. This is the answer they'd give, and I hope I do it justice. Again, capitalism is not dirty smokestacks, smut, congregation of wealth by one person. It is property and contracts together. And what any self-respecting small government property professor will tell you is, capitalism is property seen as what they call a bundle of sticks. You get sick of this metaphor. It's not just the right of possession. It's the right of possession, exclusion, lease, alienability, saleability, and many other rights as well. The distributists, they are socialists. And here's why, according to me, you hear to hear first. They will define out of the definition of property, that bundle of sticks, everything except essentially the right of possession, right? I mean, there are a couple others as well, but it becomes what they called in, I think, 18th century England, the tragedy of the commons, maybe early 19th century England as well. It's basically common property. And without the right of, I mean, the question they'll always refuse to answer, because they are egalitarians, which is the beating heart of socialism. Mm-hmm. Egalitarianism, which Thomas Aquinas defines as evil. By the way, these people will never cite Aquinas, a magisterial teaching, a pope. They don't. It's like a cult. They'll only cite, the furthest back their citations go are Chesterton and Belloc. But anyway, yeah, so in properties, proper definition, without this bundle of sticks, all of these different rights, if it's just the right of possession, which is really what you strip it down to when you do away with basically the half of libertarian property rights, contract, the right of liberty of contract, you get rid of all the property rights. And so you're essentially just in an egalitarian socialist way. You have a bunch of different people living on parceled up land. We're never told how you get your 3 acres, who it's distributed from or by, what legislative measures require it. And I think more important than anything, are you allowed to sell this once you have it? I mean, we never hear from these guys. Mm-hmm. It's the energetic state doing all of the same socialist things. I don't know if you've seen Chesterton's 6-point plan. It's the closest thing I've ever seen to. He likes what Napoleon does to heritage, to heriting. You're not allowed to pass property to your son, by the way. It's common property. And are you allowed to sell it? What if I need a surgery for my kid and I want to sell one of my 3 acres, GK? I can't do that? That's what I mean about the right of contract. So it's never clear. It's basically I'm just living on government land, with eating government cheese with a government mule. And meanwhile, it's a cult. And they're saying that they're honoring – socialism is not – there are so many different strains of socialism. There are different strains of socialism that have done this, by the way, where socialism is not against private ownership per se. They just
– Yeah. I mean, I think the difference here is mainly that I'm defining socialism more narrowly. Just, you know,
sure.
I got to start somewhere. And so it's essentially government ownership of the means of production and abolition of private property. But if you talk about socialism much more broadly construed, I totally agree. I mean, I remember the late Richard John Neuhaus saying that there's always, people are always talking about some third way between capitalism and socialism, namely socialism. You know, it always is kind of looking a lot like socialism, you know, unfortunately. And it's, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, Belloc and Chesterton were writing at the sort of the height of the progressive movement. You know, they showed sympathies to Mussolini. They showed the kind of the muscular central state. They assumed, you know, is finally going to be the sort of savior of the common person. But I do think that just the fundamentally flawed understanding of economic reality is what I always return to. I mean, just the fact that they were writing, when you hear productive property from Belloc and Chesterton, it's clear that, first of all, these guys were writers that lived, you know, essentially in urban environments. And yet they were imagining productive property as, you know, this sort of 3 acres and a mule. It's sort of the Shire. I mean, it's the Shire and the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit. That's kind of what they picture as the ideal state. Well, Tolkien didn't even, I mean, he admitted his affinities for the Shire, but he also built dignified estates and, you know, Minas Tirith and horse kingdoms and, you know, even under the ground, you know, sort of cave kingdoms. Just, you know, he was actually kind of politically and economically pluralistic, whereas distributists have this nostalgic image of the citizen farmer. And they were writing at a time in which farming was becoming a less and less sort of predominant role for most of the population. And so at the time they were writing, it was about 50% of the people in the U.S. and the U.K. at the time were farmers, that is sort of full-time farmers. Now we're way below 2%. And so productive property, the very definition of that, has changed radically, so that in the 21st century, of course, you know, I mean, productive property is essentially its know-how, its skills, its ideas, it's things like that that are actually very amorphous. I mean, Bill Gates didn't get rich by collectivizing and consolidating a bunch of farms or something like that. And so I think this just points back to its sort of, it's a nostalgia for a period that never actually existed, but that I think is quite, it's appealing. I mean, honestly, it appeals to me, that idea of having a farm that just sort of naturally productive and, you know, I'm sort of independent. That, who doesn't that appeal to? But I think it's a crazy idea to imagine this is going to apply to civilization as a whole.
There's only one distributist in The Lord of the Rings, as you guys point out. Hobbit Party's a phenomenal book. Several red pill moments for me. This has become a big issue for me. There's only one distributist character in the novels. Who is that, Jay? And can you unpack that?
There's a couple. There's of course Saruman in the novels at the end of The Lord of the Rings does a great job. He gets killed off in the movies because the Scouring of the Shire is like the fifth ending of The Lord of the Rings, maybe didn't work theatrically, but the Scouring of the Shire is the book where, you know, the hobbits get back to the Shire and they discover that Saruman and Wormtongue, they've taken over it. Created this police state, and it's
the gatherers and sheriffs.
The gatherers, sheriffs, and the sheriffs running around and controlling things, and it's obvious Tolkien's critique, not of Stalinism, it was of the kind of gray, grubby, kind of semi-socialism he was enduring in the UK at the time. There's no doubt about that. That's what he was lampooning that, and so they were distributing. And then, of course, at the end of The Hobbit, you know, when Bilbo shows up, his distant relations were redistributing his property on the assumption that he had died. It took him a long time to get his stuff back. Tolkien nowhere suggests that, well, you know, Bilbo showed up with a chest full of treasure. He had more than he needed. So, you know, I don't know, the sheriff should have redistributed that stuff. The distributist idea is just as alien to Tolkien's thought as it could possibly be. And so this was, you know, unfortunately, many really good, respected writers that I respect on Tolkien, I think, just got this wrong. They just kind of bought the story from distributists that Tolkien was of a piece with Belloc and Chesterton. They're, of course, similar in many ways. In fact, Belloc and Tolkien actually had interesting history with the Birmingham Oratory. I think Belloc was there before Tolkien. But, you know, first of all, as far as I know, Tolkien never even used the word distributism. And if you just look at his actual thought, you look at what he actually said in his letters, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't make any sense.
I'm going to throw something out that this is going to step on people's toes out there, because I think, you know, if we look at our own situation, you know, it's not a moment right now where it's, you know, you're really proud of being a Catholic. We're post-Christian as a society. There's many of us who are, you know, trying to be faithful to the teachings of the church and having large families. And so there's sort of some grumbling on the ground. And we look back in time and like, wow, the philosophy of the 13th century, man, it'd been so great to live in the 13th century. And, you know, I've studied Aristotle and I know Latin and Greek because I went to a Catholic liberal arts school. So if I lived back then, I would have been amongst the nobility and I would have had all this. And, you know, economically, wow, it's really hard to make a living and have life, medical insurance and life insurance. And man, if only we had this, like, you know, Belloc viewpoint of economics. Then so it's this sort of like false nostalgia, and people's discontent, I think, bleeds over into their philosophical desires. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think that's what's prompting most people in the in 2019 in the chat rooms and in the comments, who are just, they have their fist is just grasped around distributism so tightly, it's hard to understand why that is? Either of you.
I do think there's something to that. I always hate to attribute motives to people, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the people who most sort of vigorously advocate distributism tend to be liberal arts types that maybe are upset that they can't get paid as much as on blogging every day, you know. It's not Catholics that, you know, went to business school and are risking their wealth, right, and delaying gratification in order to try to start a business that wealth and creates value. They're not burning up the chat rooms on distributism, the ones that are doing this. Right. I do know that sometimes you do get some distributists that were in business and maybe did well at a time, and then, you know, they can quit doing that and start sort of talking about distributism. So I do know some folks like that, but I do think the type that's that there's this sort of, you know, the idea is that, look, I write wonderfully. You know, in a truly just society, I should be compensated for that. And if we're a just society like this idyllic 13th century England, I would be part of the aristocracy that's being, you know, compensated for that. And of course, you see yourself, as long as the people like me are in charge, I mean, this will all be fine. People don't pick themselves as, okay, maybe you're the impoverished peasant who would really much prefer to have a strip mall and be able to eat inexpensive pizza, you know.
Yeah, no one thinks I want to be in the 13th century in Saudi Arabia.
No, right? Nobody does. Yeah.
I want to be in the 13th century and have a compound fracture. You know, like, right. You die, they put you down. You're like a horse at that point. You know,
mm-hmm. That's exactly. And this is always the problem, is economically. I mean, Marx was wrong about virtually everything. He was right that in countries that develop economically, they do go through different stages. And so we are at a different stage economically than we were even a century ago or two centuries ago. And we should, that doesn't mean there aren't costs. I think there's a benefit to working with your hands and working on the farm and being in touch with dirt in the earth. I think every kid ideally should do some kind of physical labor growing up. But the idea that somehow that, you know, the loss of that is not worth the benefit to millions of people, I think, is just crazy. I mean, the fact that people generally don't die of dysentery, that people in the developed world generally don't die of thirst and starvation and easily treatable diseases, that is a huge benefit that's obviously worth the cost of whatever kind of minor benefit there were to farming. And a lot of people can do things better than farm and would prefer to do that. And so, look, I tell people, if you feel like you want to get off the grid and buy a small farm, do it in a market economy. Nobody's preventing you from doing that, but you can't require people to compensate you as much as you want unless you produce something that people value. That's then that seems perfectly just and reasonable to me.
Yeah, I once had it was a traditionalist guy tell me that Thomas Aquinas and the Dominicans, I'm presuming all mendicants, were communists because of their you know, their vows and all that. It's like, no, that's still, I mean, it was still kind of in fiefdoms, but that actually is capitalism. You can do that. You can choose to gather and share by private contract, as long as it's not being mandated by the center. It's still capitalism because it's free choice. It only becomes distributism or some other form of centrally planned economy, which I call socialism, when it's mandated from the center, they fundamentally don't understand contract. Again, that contract is what's binding.
Yeah, you hear it also in – I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to mention Acts. People talk about Acts.
Oh, absolutely.
And they say, look in the early church. These Christians in Jerusalem were bringing their wealth to the feet of the apostles, redistributing it. But what we don't see, that's an overflow of the charity of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. That wasn't happening in, I don't know, Antioch or Rome or Alexandria.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, if you look at the details, of course, it's right after Pentecost. Thousands of Jews to Jerusalem for the celebration of the Pentecost, and then suddenly, by the power of the Holy Spirit, have become new believers, have become Christians. And so in that context, presumably, there were some local Jews with property, and then a bunch of new Christians, new fellow believers that were away from family, away from jobs and their livelihood. And in that very kind of an emergent situation, the Spirit led the local believers sell their stuff and then share it in common. Centurions aren't knocking down doors. They're not collectivizing farms. None of that stuff's happening. This is sharing among a group of believers voluntarily for probably a short period of time. For all we know, those new believers all went back to their homes within 6 months. And so that's why you don't see Paul in any of his letters to all these other churches commending that type of arrangement as a kind of the ideal way local congregations should organize themselves. And that's never been understood in the history of the church as the way all churches and all Christian communities should exist. Nevertheless, they're free to do that. Religious orders are free to share things in common that way. But as Tim pointed out, if you look at what actual religious orders to do in the Middle Ages, it looked very much like the kind of productivity that we later associate with capitalism.
Yeah, before we get too far off the agrarianism, I have to ask. First off, I've watched your debate with Joseph Pierce a few different times over the last few years. Have you ever gotten a distributist to tell you exactly, in Chestertonian terms? Let's go. Let's go Belockian terms. That's a little spicier, as you point out in Hobbit Party. A, what is being distributed? Mm-hmm. Right. Where's this land coming from? Like outer space? If it's not redistributivism, then where's the land coming from? And B, what's the deal with the use of force in Belloc? Can you explain for the TNT audience out there what there's this real ambivalence on the part of distributists about the use of force? It was a real red pill moment for me when I read the Belloc quote in your book. So two-part question. What's being distributed, and is it forcibly redistributed?
Belloc was explicit about that. If anybody's curious, just go read his essay on the restoration of property. He said, if we're going to succeed at this, we have to get over this it's kind of squeamish attachment. Superstition, that's right.
He says superstition.
Of the use of coercion, essentially, because he understood that it was going to require state coercion. People don't give up their stuff just freely, or if they do, they're sharing. And so if they're not wanting to, the alternative is going to have to be some kind of overwhelming force. And so Belloc is quite explicit about that. I have had a very hard time getting any contemporary distributists to endorse that. My uniform experience is they say, no, we don't want to do that. We believe in limited government. We don't want big government. But then that leaves them completely without a mechanism for even implementing the policy. And so it ends up even kind of more fantastic than Belloc himself. At least Belloc really understood that, okay, if you're going to will the ends, you need to will the means as well. And in this case, a coercive government. But they're generally not clear about what's being redistributed. I think in Belloc's mind, what it essentially would have been, it would be something like an extremely progressive tax on companies or on private corporations so that, I don't know, either when they get above a certain number of employees or maybe get to a certain gross budget or something, all of a sudden the tax rate on their activity would go up, which is essentially saying, okay, if companies get good and serve too many customers and so are rewarded for that, our policy will be to punish them for it. That is literally what it means. That can only mean something different if you assume this zero-sum game idea of wealth that the labor theory of value does, in which if a company gets rich, that can only happen if somebody else is getting poor. This is just a completely bizarre and mistaken understanding of the economy. The late Steve Jobs, for all his faults, did not get rich stealing iPhones from homeless people. That's not how markets work. He participated in a process of wealth creation for himself and for millions of other people. And so what you want is an economy that allows that kind of creative potential to be realized. Some societies with certain institutions do that much better than others. Socialist countries do that terribly, and any kind of distributive scheme that would punish companies the second they get slightly too successful, it would just be a disaster economically, especially for the lowest income people in the society.
Yeah. I'm gonna drop a quote here from, because, you know, we talk about Belloc, but let's actually talk about some church teaching here. So Pope Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum, people love to quote this, but in this encyclical, Pope Leo XIII states this, quote, "Socialists, therefore, by endeavoring to transfer the possessions of individuals to the community at large, strike at the interests of every wage earner, since they would deprive him of the liberty of disposing of his wages." Tim, you kind of mentioned that earlier. He goes on to say, same quote, "and thereby of all hope and possibility of increasing his resources and of bettering his condition in life," end quote. So, I mean, just a couple things here. It strikes at the interests of the wage earner. And the person has a right of liberty to use his wages as he sees fit. So if he wants to sell 1 acre, he can sell 1 acre and buy a boat or whatever he wants to do, right? Or, you know, get a surgery for his ill daughter or whatever, you know. So, I mean, this is a pope, Rerum Novarum, by name condemning socialists. And he's calling out these errors of distribution.
Explicitly. Yeah, no, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there. It's just he's the Pope, Leo XIII, that's always being cited by these cultists.
Right.
And he's the main one that, of all popes, writes against it. Sorry, Jay.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, Rerum Novarum, 1891, he's cited. Later, of course, I think Pius XI gets cited. But, I mean, Rerum Novarum is probably high watermark in the defense of the almost absolute integrity and inviolability of private property. In fact, it's really, I think Leo's views on this are stronger than Thomas Aquinas's views. It's quite staggering when you see it. And so it's clear that what he was worried about was socialism. Now, yes, you also get in encyclicals references to capitalism, but if you look at, okay, what are they talking about? They're usually talking either about an ideology, some kind of a radical individualism that denies solidarity, or they're talking about the smokestacks and things like that. They're not talking about limited government, private property, economic freedom, the kinds of things that people that actually defend socialism mean by the word. And unfortunately, we're stuck with this word capitalism, which is really a Marxist word. I mean, Marx is the one that popularized it.
Yep.
Adam Smith knew nothing of the word. I mean, he talked about the system of liberty, but it's kind of like the word Christian. You know, a word gets coined by a critic and then we end up picking it up. And so we may be stuck with it. I like to talk about free enterprise and economic freedom as much as possible. For a while, I followed Michael Novak's strategy, which was, okay, let's try to revive this word. But at some point, you know, you give up on the rainbow flag and you give up on the word capitalism and just use another word.
Right. It's buying the premises. Capitalism, it's inherently pejorative, like you said. It's from Marx. Free enterprise is inherently good, and it's more expositive of what it expresses, what the desiderata of quote unquote capitalism are actually. When you say the point about a stronger pro-free enterprise point of view than Thomas Aquinas, and that's right, mm-hmm. Thomas has a robust view. That's a big claim. Mm-hmm. Thomas says that if you redistribute property among the people or the families, it is a fundamental corruption of the polity. Mm. I mean, he's talking about distributism. And Thomas Aquinas is also, he might not be as strong as Leo XIII on some of the finer points of capitalism, but here's where he's really strong. Mm. It's the beating heart of any form of centrally planned government, isn't it? Egalitarianism is evil. Aristotle and Thomas say it's evil. It's alien to human nature. There are different sorts, right? There is a natural aristoi, according to right. Jefferson quoting Aristotle. And what does distributism have to say to that?
Well, I mean, this is the sort of irony, because they are really radical egalitarians. I mean, and this is again, yeah. It's the kind of paradox of progressivism, in which what you want to get is a radical egalitarianism, a kind of radical individualism by way of the coercive power of the state. But at the same time, they do usually, distributists kind of see themselves as a part of the future aristocracy. I mean, at the same time, who will be in charge of the distributing, right? They'll be philosopher kings that are doing this and maybe getting the perks. And you see that. Unfortunately, I mean, if you want to see our society, actually, in many ways, is kind of manifest this now, which we have a centralized administrative state that has never been larger, that's never been more intrusive. And what is it doing? It is enforcing a kind of bizarre expressive individualism that's so radical that men can now just declare themselves to be women by the sheer act. And then not only are people allowed to do that, right, which maybe people should be free to do that, but the state is going to force us to agree to on this point. So an all-powerful state forcing us to concede the most kind of Gnostic expressive individualism. This is where this kind of craziness goes. It's completely contrary, I think, to, the sort of the fundamental ideas of Catholic teaching, certainly contrary to the ideas of the American founding and the American experiment. I think, look, limited government, that is a good thing. Every Catholic should believe in that. If you believe in the sovereignty and dignity of the family, of the individual, of human rights and human dignity, if you believe in the integrity of the church, you need to believe in limited government. And two of the Ten Commandments presuppose the right to private property. So we're already kind of getting the fundamentals of a market economy just from the very foundational truths of the faith. Then when we take what we've actually learned about what works and doesn't work in economics, especially microeconomics, I think there just is no better alternative economically than a limited government, private property, rule of law, and economic freedom. That's just the best that I think we're going to get this side of global. And all these other things are either chimeras or very dangerous utopias.
Can I throw in a quote on that? So we talked about Leo XIII. The other great one is Pius IX. Mm. And he wrote Quadragesimo Anno. This was 40 years after Rerum Novarum. Mm-hmm. And he's, 40 years later, people are saying, well, yeah, Leo XIII, he condemned socialism, and that's really bad. But we're Christian socialists. I think even for a while, mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis called himself a Christian socialist.
Yeah, he toyed with this.
Yeah, I mean, he was an Anglican. But I mean, so that was the comeback. Okay, well, we're not socialists like Leo XIII said. We're Christian socialists. And so Pius XI said, no, we're not having any of that. He says, quote, religious socialism, Christian socialism are contradictory terms. Mm-hmm. No one can be at the same time a good Catholic and a true socialist, end quote. And then I'd like for y'all to comment also on this other quote by Pius XI, because y'all were saying, yeah, maybe we should retreat on capitalism. Maybe in 2019, that's the right approach. I'm a little hesitant on that because we have some papal teaching endorsing the term capitalism. So I'm not ready to retreat. But
no, I agree.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Here's the quote. Again, this is Pius XI. And everybody listen very closely to this. He says, quote, capitalism itself is not to be condemned, and surely it is not vicious of its very nature, but it has been vitiated. And if you read Quadragesimo, Pius XI says, socialism is in se, it's intrinsically evil. Mm-hmm. It's always bad, never good, not even a religious or Christian version. But capitalism as an instrument can be good or evil. It's not in its essence evil. And so I like that quote because he carved out capitalism.
Yeah. I love that quote. Yeah, neither of us were saying it should retreat. We're saying the term. It's a Marx coined the term. Sorry.
Exactly. That's the dilemma. And so that's why I often, just for purposes of understanding, you end up kind of having to go with the words that are used. The even better quote, that's terrific because it's from Quadragesimo Anno, way back in 1931. Then, of course, you have John Paul II's quote in Centesimus Annus, in which says, well, so here we are, the Soviet Union has collapsed, we're trying to decide what should European countries do that were under the, we're under the foot of communism. Should we propose essentially capitalism? And then he says, quite famously, if by capitalism you mean this, in which he names the things that defenders of capitalism mean, then we answer in the affirmative. If we mean by it, kind of the rapacious individualism and all these kinds of things, then of course we would have to deny it. That's just perfect John Paul. I mean, he's nuanced. He says, look, depends on how you define the term. But if you define the term as advocates and proponents define it, then yes, it's something we should commend to the nations of the world who are concerned about development. That's why I got involved in this. I didn't get, I myself am a liberal arts person. I'm not, right. Don't work in business, but I believe the power of ideas. And I have looked at what actually works, at what actually helps the people of the world. And it's market economies. It's what has helped the Indians since 1990, who languished under the misbegotten sort of socialist policies of the British Empire from, you know, basically its independence until around 1990, and then started market reforms. And the country has turned around, is continuing to do so. So it's not like we don't know where wealth comes from. It's not like we don't know what institutions allow cultures to emerge from absolute poverty. We know this in 2019. The question is, how do we best implement them and get them to be adopted in those places that have not done so?
Yeah, Mussolini to Soroman, different forms of Christian socialism seem to pop back up. They're like cockroaches every time. I think this is what's really insightful and what Taylor pointed out. You beat it back down. You know, you beat down the secular socialists at the beginning of the 20th century, and then a Christian socialism is creeping up. You pointed out in the form of what C.S. Lewis was advocating. And then you beat that back down. And now on the really, really steady rise, I think it's a really dangerous cultish, it's got a cultish following, it's a fan favorite, is a new form of Christian socialism. It's distributism. Yeah. And these people, I might be more frustrated because I've been debating them on Twitter the last few weeks.
Right.
They are really, they don't understand. They need to be red-pilled. Root and branch, there's not just one dimension of distributism that's evil. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the means are bad. It's that the goal is fundamentally radically egalitarian, and it's really bad. It's that even historical red flags, like mm-hmm. the French Revolution, have been what's the deal with Chesterton and the French Revolution? Have you seen these quotes, Jay?
Absolutely. It's terrifying. In fact, I didn't realize this until we were actually working on the Hobbit Party of these sympathies with the French Revolution, which is staggering because, I mean, of course, Chesterton had the benefit of hindsight at that point. That's what's
right.
sort of surprising. But again, it's the egalitarian ideal. Chesterton was essentially a critic of the Anglo-American, what you might call classical liberal tradition. And so, you know, American historians and political scientists will so often distinguish between the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And in many ways, the kind of, frankly, anti-liberal in the positive sense, French Revolution, it makes sense that Chesterton would kind of see some things he liked about it. I'm just sort of surprised because, of course, we know how that revolution turned out. But I mean, this is the kind of the power of ideas. And I do think that there's a resurgence of this. What's funny is that among some Orthodox Catholics, they're talking about distributism. Some are actually talking about socialism. I mean, you have, you know, editors of First Things magazine, who's, you know, very much a social conservative at the same time, endorses socialism by name. Is I think this stuff's very, very dangerous. And it really worries me because there are absolutely no new arguments. These are not
right.
new ideas. You know, I've got this other book that, you know, Tim, Money, Greed, and God, came out in 2009 talking about these things. I've got a new edition coming out here in June. And I beefed up the stuff on socialism because if anything, 10 years ago, people were making socialist arguments but not endorsing the term. Now we've got millennials by bare majority saying they'd like to live in a socialist country. Now, they never hear definition before they answer the questions in the poll, but
yeah, they mean know, I want my parents' property distributed to me.
I want the government to pay for my student loans that I've built up. Yeah, that's what I mean. I want everyone to have a nice hut in a Norwegian village with a Volvo. And, you know,
but ironically, if you want your parents' stuff, then just go under a traditional common law system of devise, i.e., capitalism. Like I pointed out before, Chesterton was for Napoleon. That's right, Napoleon's system of eradicating common law devise. You're not even allowed under one of the points of Napoleonic Chestertonianism to pass your property to your kids. I mean, that's not standard socialism. Maybe you can. I don't know.
It is standard socialism. If you look at the Communist Manifesto, you know, they list Marx and Engels, sort of 10 things that precede socialism, and universal education, and actually the essentially 100% inheritance tax, the abolition of the right of inheritance. And it's got to go, because that's the way in which private wealth is essentially, you know, sort of established over long periods of time. But I really do think just understanding basic economic reality, that free exchange, it can be mutually beneficial, in which both parties actually benefit as a result of it. Wealth can be created rather than merely transferred, because we're creatures made in the image of God. We can transform sand into fiber optic cables and computer chips. These basic economic truths, once you understand them, you realize all the promises of distributism are based on false assumptions about economic reality. And I just think we need to accept the fact that you can have people that are great thinkers and highly insightful, people like Bella Chesterton on some things, or Chesterton is a fabulous writer. His book Orthodoxy played a major role in my own views, my own Christian faith, and just be wrong on economics. Just like a person, you know, like Aristotle could be really good on some things, but just wrong when it came to slavery. We just need to accept that reality in order to appropriate historical thinkers and accept, look, Chesterton was great on some things. He was just confused on economics.
Yeah, I think sure. Yeah, I don't want to be the touchy Aristo Thomas. It's like whoa. But I mean, there's when a thinker is systematic like Aristotle or Thomas, and they conceive of the whole. Because I like Chesterton as an aphorist too. Who doesn't? I mean, amazing aphorist. But he's not a systematic thinker. That when you look at Aristotle or Thomas, and you say, let me consult them on economics. Neither of them are known as economists. The reason they get that right, even though you're right, they are each wrong. They each have bugaboos, like John C. Reilly says in Step Brothers. There's a bugaboo or two with Aristotle. There's fewer with Thomas. But they're systematic thinkers, and that enables them to basically dial up like a you know, Dewey Decimal System. Mm. You just go to an issue, and because they have the right philosophy of man as a systematic thinker, they get the basically right political economy. I mean, this is what the Nicomachean Ethics was. Yeah. It was a primer for the politics, which is called On the Family or On the Family Economy.
Yeah,
they both get it right, even though they're ancient. Chesterton, he's a great one-line dropper and some deep insights, but I am staggered by the lack of citation by Chesterton and by the Chestertonians to anything older in our, you know, erstwhile blessed patrimony of the church. It's staggering.
Tim, that's a great way of putting it, because Chesterton is really, he's a great aphorist, as you said. And so he's very good at the kind of witty turn of phrase, the distillation of an insight. That's why he's, you know, on Twitter constantly. I'm constantly retweeting his quotes. But yeah, I mean, once you put it that way, I think it's exactly right. He's not a global systematic thinker like a Thomas Aquinas. What's funny is that somebody like Tolkien actually was much more global. That's what I was surprised. Honestly, when Jonathan Witt and I first started to work on this book, we hadn't gotten as deeply into the secondary literature as we would later. And to discover that Tolkien was able to connect things and did connect things in a remarkably subtle way, so that he ended up with really a much more capacious and nuanced view of even economics and trade than we had really expected. We both suspected, look, he's never endorsed distributism, but we kind of assumed he'd sort of confused on some things. I was actually surprised at how when you read him deeply and you read his private letters, the way in which he extricated himself from some of the common confusions of people that, you know, are otherwise alive and well in his time with people like Chesterton.
That's well put. It is surprising. Yeah, even when you look at, you dial up Tolkien, kind of like the Dewey Decimal System on marriage. Yeah, I think in that letter 41 he wrote to his son, it's like, wow, this is not drippy Spielbergian sentimentalism. He's like, I mean, what he says on even just something random like marriage is not what you'd expect from like a holy roller guy. It's really practical and
it
really,
really
shrewd and really true. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the income tax, you know, and he tells, don't talk to me about the income tax and all of my earnings, you know, until I retired from all of his writings. And that's what's sort of delightful. I mean, I have to say it was one of the most enjoyable. It was the most enjoyable book I have ever worked on and probably ever will work on. I was actually, my wife and I and family were living temporarily on a farm on Vashon Island, Washington in the summer. I'm reading The Lord of the Rings and writing about it. You know, I mean, this is not my normal kind of day-to-day work, you know, but it's absolutely delightful. And so I think, look, if you want to read a Catholic essayist that can feed your moral and economic intuitions, go to Tolkien. Read Tolkien. He'll do you well. And just make sure you don't bring all of your untutored economic intuitions to it. Make sure you understand a little bit about economic reality.
Is there a possibility of correcting the ship here and getting a lot of our really bright liberal arts, conservative, you know, Christian thinkers who understand Catholic history and Christendom? Can we correct the ship here and get people to think critically about this? And can we have a Christian capitalist understanding that incorporates all the, you know, all the arguments against it, which are it's not merciful, it's rapacious, it's mean. I mean, could we do something like you see Jordan Peterson? He says, you know, look at these first world capitalist nations and how many millions of people have been lifted out of poverty.
And I hope so. That's what, honestly, what I spend my time doing. And I assume that's why Tim spends so much time arguing about this, is that we think, you know, now, am I going to persuade the guy that has spent 20 years talking about distributism and absolutely refuses to read a single book on economics? No, probably not. But
it's a lot to ask.
We should be able to persuade rational fence sitters who are willing to look at the arguments in the evidence. I mean, I know that anybody that, you know, just has read the book Common Sense Economics or something, and it understands what comparative value is and specialization of labor, actually gets it. They're well on their way, because I really do think the thing that's at stake here is, look, are there economic truths and realities or not? Is economics just a bunch of battling political ideologies, or are there truths that we've discovered about social reality that we need to take account of when we're applying our ethics in the economic realm? And the answer is yes or no. And if there are economic truths, then what are they? What are the ones that we're certain of? What are the ones that we think are probably right that we need to take into our analysis? Just as if you were going to apply, you're a Christian bridge engineer, you're going to apply good principles of engineering. If you're going to do social ethics that has something to do with economic policy and development, there are going to be economic truths that you need to take account of. And I think reasonable people that have not already committed themselves to the proposition that there are no economic truths are persuadable. I found that that they are persuadable, but sometimes it takes some time. It's why I write books like The Hobbit Party and Money, Greed, and God, is I want to convince the reasonable fence sitters.
Hobbit Party is such an excellent book. People should go out and get a copy for themselves. What I never hear, I almost never hear, are robust defenses of free enterprise capitalism on the basis of our Catholic defenses of free will, especially the sort that arose after the Reformation when the free will was under Christian attack. You defend capitalism if you believe in man's right to do with his time, or, you know, like Gandalf tells Frodo, it's your choice to do with the time. All you have to decide is what to do with the time that's given you. That is capitalism. And it is a reflecting glass. It's not a crystal ball, is what I tell people on Twitter. It's not, if we have a wicked, decadent society that's full of porn and smut and dirty smokestacks, then it will reflect that back to us. But if we're doing things properly, properly ordered liberty is first.
That's right.
And if we have a Christian society based on virtue ethics, capitalism is the only way that will reflect that back to us without perverting those good values. I never hear that free will defense. Sorry.
You don't, and it should be there, because, I mean, what we've got instead is these kind of, just sort of sweeping condemnations of liberalism and individual rights as if it's all the kind of the result of some recent Enlightenment thinker like Hobbes, and not actually the result of sort of deep roots in Christian theology. But for people that have complaints about, well, when you give people economic freedom, they might choose wrongly, could say that about God giving us freedom too. I mean, the precondition of freedom is that people can choose wrongly. And so God apparently thought it was important enough to create beings with that capacity. And so it doesn't, having a free economy doesn't substitute for a robust virtue forming civil society and family and church, all of which are tasked with that job. And if you don't have it, I'm convinced with Michael Novak that you need a healthy political sphere, you need a healthy economic sphere or market, and you need a healthy civil society sphere. And if you don't have all three of those legs of the social stool, you're going to end up in trouble. And unfortunately, at the moment, these things are kind of out of whack, and the institutions of civil society are under attack either from without or from within.
Yep.
Well said. Yeah. That's very well said.
So,
have you ever gotten a distributist to tell you where the property comes from? That can be a yes, no.
Never gotten it. And it's usually, I do think that ultimately, if they're picturing landed property, then it can't really finally be sold off. It's sort of like the, the tribes of Israel, in which you had a jubilee year, and so they could sort of rent it out for 50 years, but then back to its original owner. You'd have to have kind of something like that. But it's the problem is that once you start thinking about distributism at a practical level and thinking what policies would get us to that, even assuming it's achievable, the thing falls apart because it has these contradictory tendencies. Now, Belloc's view of this didn't fall apart. He just endorsed, coercive power of the state. He just bit that bullet. Most distributists aren't willing to do that because they don't want to sound like progressives. They don't want to sound like socialists. It is what it is. I mean, if you want a political philosophy, you got to work out its implications. If it's contradictory, that tells you something about the political philosophy, and it needs to be reworked.
What do you two think about the current temptation and trajectory that we see in the Catholic Church, maybe Christianity at large, I know it happens in Protestantism as well, to embrace progressive socialism at all? I mean, we see this even with Pope Francis. We see it in sermons. We see it in conferences of bishops. It's becoming more popular. It relates a little bit to liberation theology, but it seems like the trajectory of the United Nations and the EU and certain policies like that are being endorsed by Christians. In particular, I'm thinking under Pope Francis. So either of you take it away.
Yeah, Tim, you want on that?
Well, I'm here's why it's such a bugaboo with me, the distributism issue. Because it's coming from the sources that ought to be right-minded about this. As Taylor, as you and I talk about three times a week here on TNT, the more recent, more overt, less camouflaged iterations of socialism, communism that stole into the church in like St. Gallen, the likes of McCarrick, the likes of the people that gave us Pope Francis, those are relatively unabashed leftists now, now that they have power, right? So you expect it. I mean, in a certain sense, there's less bickering between, a Nazi and an allied force because you're just enemies. There's nothing to quibble about. You're either just going to kill each other or not. The war ends before you kill each other. But you get into the real bitter bickering with people that are supposed to be fellow travelers because I'm always having this argument with people when I go to Latin Mass, frankly. I'll come out and say it. It's the Latin Mass. There's a lot that I'm like, man, you guys get it on liturgy. You get it on so many issues. But then distributism is one of the issues, and there are others where I just don't think, if I'm generalizing here, they don't get it. It's like the expectation is higher. So distributism go ahead.
Totally agree, Tim, because I think you're right. I mean, we know what liberation theology is, what it was and what it is. It's essentially an integration of Christian and Catholic theology. It's really a theological overlay on Marxist social analysis, if you look at it carefully. And so the people that it sort of endorsed that are also going to be on the left on life issues, are going to be on the left probably on contraception and family. You kind of know what that is. Distributists almost entirely are on... or social conservatives. They're very good on family. They're very good on, the integrity of the church and liturgy, as Tim said. And so that's what makes it a little more confusing because it's like, well, they're really good on all these other things. And I think for many of them, it's because they've been told that, well, this is what the church teaches. And so they believe in the kind of perennial teaching of the church. And so if you're told, oh, this is what Leo XIII taught. This is the Catholic view of economics. Then you think that being a traditionalist requires this. But look, distributism was invented, you know, a century or so ago. This is a new thing. It's a new idea.
Perennial teaching of the church. They don't make any references to it.
No, exactly. This is very, very recent pedigree. In fact, not only was it recent, it was short-lived. It didn't, other than a few thinkers, you know, kind of on the fringes, it never actually has gone anywhere. You know, it's not like there have been distributist political parties that have actually gained seats in parliaments or anything like that. You know, and so this idea that that's the Catholic view, you know, the Catholic view should be a universal view that's sort of widely held. And this clearly is not that. And so I'm the first person to say, look, I don't think that being Catholic requires you to have very specific economic views beyond endorsing private property and contracts and, you know, human dignity. On the other hand, I think if you just look at economic reality at how different societies work themselves out, you can noodle out which systems work better than others. And it's not like this is kind of secret. We know what works and what doesn't. And so it's just frustrating that we keep having to have the same conversations over and over again.
Yeah. Jay, do you subscribe at all to, this can be a yes or a no if you want to keep it short, Austrian economics at all? They're vilified by some of the parties.
That's right. I like the Austrians, and I especially like Hayek. I don't go all the way with them. I think Hayek, for instance, and I've written articles critiquing his anthropology because he ends up being kind of a materialist ultimately. So I don't buy that. But yeah, but I'm with him when he talked, you know, his work on the information capacity of prices and the need for market order, things like that. I think that Hayek's economic insights are better embedded, though, in a kind of robustly Catholic view of reality. And I'm with the Austrians when it comes to central banks and the dangers of fiat currency and all those kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, terms of my actual thinking, I would say it relies very much on, certainly on economics, Thomas Sowell, the great American economist, but then on Michael Novak, the late Michael Novak, and George Gilder, who I think they both have original and unique insights that sort of extend the work of these traditional economists.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. They've been, again, the last 10 years, vilified in some corners of the church. And, that's absurd. Yeah. You don't have to, again, they're not global thinkers, the Austrians.
I wrote a blog post. I don't know, 8 years ago on something that had to do with tangentially on Austrians, and people called me and like, you better be careful on that, man. You can't say that in the Catholic Church. Yeah. 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 Well, you just watch. We're going to get some comments on that. We're going to get some comments on this. Watch this. Yeah.
No, I mean, this is, you know, unfortunately, I'm glad we're talking about this stuff because
I am too.
I'm passionate about it, but if anything, it's more current now than was 5 or 10 years ago, and there's confusions galore, whether you're talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, on the left, or you're talking about the distributist sort of on the right. But I mean, you know, economic illiteracy is not uniquely on the left. You can be confused about the nature of wealth creation and trade and prices, you know, and have all sorts of kind of political views attached to that. That's why I think, you know, I've been working for 2 years on a paper that I've just submitted to an academic journal on, it's called What Economists Know and What They Debate, which I try to separate. Okay, what are the propositions economists agree on, whatever their political views? I found about 30. It took me about 2 years of back and forth to find these. But there are at least 30 propositions that we pretty well know are true and that every economist understands and that every social ethicist that's going to talk about economics really needs to get down in their bones if they're going to be literate when they're talking about economics.
That right-wing economic illiteracy is amply demonstrated when you talk to the distributists, right? Absolutely. I mean, it comes home to roost.
And they're the same confusion. It's not like they're different. Maybe they have different political philosophies and a different understanding of the family.
Precisely.
But, you know, it's basically the same confusions.
Yeah, I'm a convert, you know, into Catholicism, and so I've lived on each side of the fence. And I find it interesting. In fact, one of the apologetics that Protestants will sometimes make is, look at all those Catholic countries and how poor they are. See, Catholicism sucks. You know, horrible. It's an argument that's made. And I'd heard it before, but it's something that I think about. And, you know, why is it that Catholic political orders fall to this sort of thinking, whereas Protestant political orders tend to remain more based on a open free market economy? Why is that? Yeah. Some people have said, well, it goes back to serfdom or whatever, but I'd like to hear, you know, especially Dr. Richard, your take on that. Why are Catholics particularly open to this kind of error.
This bothered me, and I too am a convert. In fact, it will be 10 years this Easter Vigil, and it worried me, you know. But I really like the argument that Rodney Stark makes in his book, The Victory of Reason. He said it's not anything kind of specifically Catholic so much as looking at the different patterns of the Spanish and Portuguese colonizations, and they were more extractive. Go over there, get the gold, bring it back. The British and the Dutch, when they, of course, colonized and moved, they had to go to North America because the South America, the kind of rich, resource-rich part of the Americas, had already been taken. So they were stuck with the North, and they had to develop institutions. And they also tended to develop trading partners and trading colonies rather than these kind of extractive institutions where you get the gold and bring it back. And so, and of course, Stark points out that all the institutions we identify with capitalism actually started in northern Italian city-states before the Reformation. It's that, you know, they got corrupted, and then these institutions ended up moving to places like, you know, Flanders and Belgium and the Netherlands now, in northern Europe, which had become Protestant. And so we tend to now associate these institutions with Protestantism. And this is why some Catholic critics of capitalism will call capitalism Calvinist. But I think that's a mistake. It's mixing up all the weird contingencies of history. I don't think there's anything kind of unique, uniquely in terms of an affinity between Protestantism and free market economies. I just think the patterns of colonization were different. They took place a century apart, and it led to these generally more abundant economies in the South and vibrant economies in the North.
Fair enough. I like that.
It's a good off the cuff answer. Yeah. Historically based. That was nice. You also have the of course prosperity gospel in the American context, which make, you know, binds it all up.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, that's just little slices of Protestantism though.
Yes, you know? Exactly. It's little
parts
slices
of Calvinism.
Yeah, there's this, you know, the famous book by Max Weber. He's the one that coined the term, that, you know, Protestant work ethic.
Right.
You know, historians right away said, what are you talking about? This doesn't sound like Calvinism, what you described. It turns out he doesn't have theological resources at his disposal. He didn't read theologians. His dad had a kind of quirky kind of what he thought of as Calvinism, and that's where Weber got it. But all he was talking about was essentially a pattern of personal discipline in which you work hard and you're productive and you create wealth, and you don't consume all the wealth, but you save some of it and you reinvest it. So you delay gratification. And any society that, or any religious or political or philosophical view that cultivates that kind of attitude will develop healthy institutions of what Weber called capitalism. But Weber was ultimately sort of viciously anti-Catholic, and there's no doubt that his argument was sort of intended in that in those terms. And so I really like Rodney Stark's arguments that the best things that we think of in free enterprise or in capitalism, rightly construed, are anchored deeply in the Christian tradition and are not unique to some particular Protestant sect or even just a Catholic.
All I find insightful in Weber is his almost self-critical Protestant analysis of its sacramental theology. He says quite nicely, he says, look, without the quotidian grace of the seven sacraments, American, particularly Calvinist Puritans, needed some form of daily grace, and they got it through labor. And then and he
through
quotes,
their work.
You know, a few preachers. Yeah, but it's psychologically gratifying for a Catholic to read that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And he was right that religion plays an important role. I mean, sociologists at the time, you know, and these thinkers were pretending that religion and theology were just sort of ephemera. He thought, no, actually, your religious views might actually dictate the outcome of your economy. And so I think he was right on that point. He just got a lot of the details wrong.
Yep.
Well, in terms of your debate with Joseph Pierce, that was just work on behalf of the Lord. Thank you for that. And again, A Hobbit Party, everyone should go out and get it. It's an amazing book, a very entertaining book. We are given it as a gift. I'd already been in contact with you. I also want to thank you just on a personal note. I think I talked to you first in 2014 when I was working 60 hours a week at a law firm trying to get my first book finished. And you gave me some very very helpful advice about how to get the book finished. And it's been valuable to me. I've cited it to several people. So I appreciate your on a personal basis, the advice you gave me back in 2014 and your work in Hobbit Party and all your good Catholic economic work there at CUA.
Well, thanks so much. It's good to be with both you guys. Really admire your work. It's fun to finally meet, at least sort of in person here virtually.
Yeah, yeah.
And thanks for, this is nice to have a good, robust, lengthy conversation about these things.
Yeah. I'd like to have you back sometime, Dr. Richards. I'd like to talk about specifically Thomistic understandings of the economy, maybe get into the Salamanca and the Dominicans there. I mean, there's a lot of great things that I think we as traditional Catholics, Thomists, there's a lot to unearth there that hasn't been unearthed. Everybody's just like, oh, distributism, that's what we do. No, well, we need to get into that Thomistic stream there.
And in fact, I was at a conference and gave a paper in Rome at the Angelicum in December about one of the Salamancans. And let's talk about that. That's a whole other discussion. The reality is we have almost all the insights of free market economics. You can find them at least in, you know, kind of the seminal and early form in this school of Salamanca, centuries, you know, completely detached from whatever you think of the English Enlightenment. So let's definitely talk about that sometime.
For sure. Okay.
Juan de Mariana. Yeah.
Good stuff.
So speaking of Dominicans, everybody pray that rosary, stay faithful to our church in all things, including your money. And until next time, God bless you all. Signing out.